Hey, everybody. Welcome to First Thursday, the monthly podcast from Labor Relations Information System. My name is Rick Paulson. I'm the executive director of LRIS and the lucky host of this monthly podcast. And so we're doing this one for the month of June 2026. Not sure where you are, what you're doing as you listen here, but it's June 3rd. I'm in the great city of Philadelphia. It's like 75 degrees and sunny. It's absolutely perfect weather. So I hope it's good weather wherever you are. Actually, I hope it's bad weather. That's probably why you would be listening. But anyhow, it's a nice day in Philadelphia. And here I am stuck in LRIS studios recording a podcast. It's all good. Quick update. Last time I was on this podcast, it seems like a million years ago because the 76ers had actually won a playoff round against the Boston Celtics. Of course, they went on to get destroyed by the Knicks. And the Knicks have gone on a tear. And as I record this, right, tonight is the first night of the NBA Finals. So good luck, Knicks. Good luck, Spurs. We have some New York, New Jersey people, and we have some San Antonio people for sure who listen to this thing. So I wish you guys all best of luck. And I am very conflicted about the Knicks. As a Philadelphian, I've sworn to hate the Knicks and all New York teams. That said, what a long-suffering and great fan base. So you'd like to see something good happen. So we shall see what happens. Good luck in the NBA Finals. All right. What are we going to talk about this month? Remember, last month we did a kind of a special episode, by the way, on gambling. And it seems like, sometimes when you think of something, that you see three of those, or you learn something and you see it all the time. I don't know whether it was that or just it's in the news, but after I recorded that gaming, the episode on gaming issues, last week, which I encourage you to listen to if you haven't listened to, that stuff is all over the news, right? Concerns about gambling addiction, with the proliferation of these apps, just concerned about the general betting sites and insider training. I just see it, everywhere. So I don't know, maybe we're out front of the trend. Fortunately, I haven't seen too many issues in the news with police officers, firefighter, correction officers getting jammed up. Hopefully that will continue to be the case. We shall see. But I guess that brings us up to date. I guess the only other thing is it's June. So we have our Rights of Police seminar in Las Vegas this month. So if you are looking for something to do in June, I think it's June 17th, 18th, and 19th. That is correct. In Vegas, the weather, by the way, beautiful. Mid-June in Vegas, beautiful. Actually, it's super nice. It's like 100 degrees, but it's like, I don't know. It is and is bad. It's actually pretty cool. You go hang out by the pool. But we're going to be the Horseshoe and the Paris Hotels right there in the heart of the Strip in Vegas. It's really a fun time, and it's a great seminar. You're probably too close to this to make a reservation, but if you want to be a last-minute person, head on out there to Vegas. Have some fun. We'd love to see you. Usually, the World Series of Poker is like right around now, and it's at the Horseshoe. So if you're a poker player, lots of fun there too. If you miss us, which you probably will in June, come back and see us. We're going to be back in Vegas in September for our Enforcing the Contract seminar. That's grievances, discipline cases, other workplace rights, pay rights, all of the ways, and the strategies that we use to enforce collective bargaining agreements. And that's on the union side and on the management side, right? So we'll have management speakers as well talking about contract enforcement issues. That seminar looks like it's going to be a lot of fun. A lot of people are coming out for that one. Finally in November, the beginning of November, 4, 5, 6, we're going to be back in Nashville. We love going to Nashville. We're going to be at the Sonesta for our best practices in public safety discipline seminar. So 2.5 days of discipline issues. Always interesting cases to talk about, and always timely issues. So if you want to check out any of that, get us at LRIS.com/seminars. You can, if you have any questions about any of the seminars, just email us, email me. If you just email info@lrs.com, that'll make its way to me. If you have any questions or comments about our LRS seminars. And by the way, another thing you can check out on the website is custom seminars. We've been doing a lot of custom seminars where we'll go to a state, so a state FOP or firefighters or whatever, right? You may bring us to their convention or bring us out for a special seminar in your city. And do what we do in a national level, but to kind of focus it to where you are, and we work with your local lawyers, and that's usually a lot of fun. We have a lot of those lined up for the summer. Fortunately, they're actually in some pretty good places that I want to go in the summer. So good for me. But you can get info on that at the website too at lrs.com. All right, when we come back, we're going to talk about cases. And this month is not a special episode. It's special in that we're not going to be talking about anything special. We're just going to be going through some of the more interesting cases that have come across our desks over the last month or two. And so for those of you who like to talk about a bunch of different cases during this podcast, this is a good episode for you. Stick around. We'll be right back with First Thursday. Okie doke, we're back. We're ready to roll with case number one. We have four cases this month. Some are from the May Public Safety Labor News newsletter because I didn't talk about them last month. And then we've got a couple from the June edition of the newsletter. Four cases. They're all pretty much kind of like bargaining labor board cases because we've had, a handful of interesting ones. And we start in a really small place and we wind up in not that big a place. There's kind of small and mid-sized departments are where the cases are coming out of, you know, that are of interest anyway this month. But we start in the mighty metropolis of Hatch, New Mexico. Don't call it a city because it's a village. The village of Hatch, all 1,680 of them, the people, that's not the size of the department. That is the size of the town. What's the department size in Hatch, New Mexico, you might ask? Six officers. So we have a little place in New Mexico, and it's near Las Cruces. My dear friend ChatGPT tells me that Las Cruces is the chili pepper capital of the world. Whether that's true or whether that's just another AI hallucination, I don't know. But this case comes out of there. It's a pretty interesting case. It's a take-home vehicle case. And take-home vehicle things come up from time to time. And so that's why I thought this case was interesting. And then the second case actually is also relates to take-home vehicles. So we've had a little string of those. So we want to talk about them. So it's a police department case. The name of the case is Village of Hatch Police Officers Association versus Village of Hatch. It's a case that comes out of New Mexico's Public Employee Labor Relations Board. It was decided, May 19th of this year. So it's pretty recent case. And you can get the sites and find these cases, on the website, with the show notes related to the show. Or you can read the newsletter. So Village of Hatch, they have a take-home vehicle policy. They've had one since 2004. So they've had one for a long time. For many, many years, it was limited to the chief and the lieutenant. So the chief and the lieutenant of the department, would get take-home vehicles and so long as they live within a 15-mile radius. And out there, like 15 miles is like two blocks, you know what I mean? So it's a pretty tight radius, only two people got it. This wasn't negotiated. It was just implemented by the village, keep that in the back of your head, right? Not negotiated. They have this policy. It benefits a couple of people. Let's fast forward 16 years, April of 2020, right? COVID happens. And for reasons that really still aren't clear to me how any of this relates to COVID, to be honest with you, the police department decides, other than maybe they just, I don't even know, but the police department decides or the village decides they're going to change their take-home vehicle policy to include everybody. And so every police officer would have a take-home vehicle, so they're going to be able to take their patrol vehicles home. They expanded the radius to 45 miles. That's a weird radius. It could be that they tripled the 15-mile radius. It could be that they looked at where everybody lived and they captured everybody. I don't know. That's not in the case notes or it's not in the text of the case. But they significantly expanded and improved their take-home vehicle policy. Just like in 2004, the policy was not negotiated. The village just kind of expanded their policy. They did argue that this was a COVID retention incentive, and it could have been like guys were like, hey, man, I'm out. I'm not working during this. And it was what's it going to take to keep you working? Here, take the car. I don't know. It wasn't clear. They did say that they implemented it as a safety precaution during COVID. And also that there was some type of recruiting and retention aspect to it. That's what the village says. So we're going to take them at their word. All is well with the world, right? They implement, well, I guess not because it was COVID, but other than COVID and the millions of people dying, all is well with the world. And in the village of Hatch, we had a take-home vehicle policy. The officers liked it. Every place that has a take-home vehicle policy, the officers like it. And there were no issues. The issues came up in September of 2025 in the fall when the village decided that the take-home vehicle program had become too costly and that they needed to scuttle it. Now, that the notes in the case indicate that the village said that the costs of the take-home vehicle policy were 25% of their annual expenditures that year. That doesn't make any sense to me. It can't be possible. So if you know the backstory, if you're one of six officers in Hatch, you know, email me and let me know what the deal is. That seems very strange. But something was going on. It was costing them too much. And they decided they were, maybe they realized COVID was over and they were going to roll back this policy. And what happened, right? Now, this policy wasn't negotiated in 2004. It wasn't negotiated when they expanded it in 2020. But they go to take it away. They didn't negotiate it, right? Because we gave it to you. We can take it from you, right? They take it away and the police oppose that. And they take the position that, no, you cannot unilaterally remove this take-home vehicle program that we have, this benefit that we have without bargaining with us. What did the village say in response? They say what every employer in that position says. And I've been doing this, you know, for a while, and I've been down this road many times, where the employer does something, right? They come up with some good idea or some benefit they think is going to help people. They implement it. It's something that is a mandatory subject of bargaining, and then they change their mind and they want to get rid of it. And the union says, "Not so fast, my friend." You know, and the employer always says, "We didn't even bargain this." You know, sometimes you didn't even want this. And we get to say, you know, nicely, tough shit. You know, if it's a mandatory subject to bargaining, you have to bargain with us before you're going to get rid of it. And I'll tell you probably a couple stories about that as we move through this episode. But that's what happened in Hatch. They wanted to get rid of the, or they did get rid of the take-home vehicle policy. The union filed a charge. And we wind up working our way up to the New Mexico Labor Relations Board. The union takes the arguments before the board. And basically the argument was that, you know, there was nothing in the contract about this. There was no memo of agreement locking in the take-home vehicle policy it was implemented, which, by the way, that's a best practice. If the employer implements something and says, "Hey, here's this new thing," you can just say, "Great job, you know, chief. Let's just confirm, you know, we agree to this policy." You know, when you have something in writing, and then it's a little harder for them to change it. Employer, you know, think about, you know, the flip side of that. You know, if you want to do something that you really need to be temporary, you know, you might want to say, "Hey guys, we have this great thing we want to do. We're not sure if we can do it forever. Let's do it as a pilot, or maybe we'll do it for a temporary period of time, but we want you to agree on the front end with us that, cause we don't have to do this. We will do this, but we have the right to get rid of it." Right. And 9 times out of 10, the union's going to say, "Okay, sure. Why not?" Right. And now if you change your mind, you know, you've addressed it up front. Right. And so, none of that happened here in the village of Hatch. Not saying it should have, you know, hindsight's 2020. If people didn't run into any of those issues, I would need a real job. So I'm not complaining about it. But, you know, that's pretty much what happened in Hatch. The union said, "This is a binding past practice. There's nothing in writing. There's nothing in the contract. We get it. There's not a memo of agreement. We get it. But you gave us a benefit. And you continued that benefit for an extended period of time. There was a financial impact to it. There was a safety impact to it. And that has become what we call a binding past practice." What's a binding past? What's a past practice, right? Everybody likes to say, you know, past practice. By the way, if you're interested in this, we have a session on past practices at the Rights of Police Seminar in June. And the great Will Acheson, former host of this podcast, is actually going to be making that presentation. He could talk about past practices all day long. Just because there are just so many disputes about it, and there's so much confusion about what constitutes a binding past practice. But he's going to talk, I think, for about 90 minutes about it. And the union in this particular instance, you know, alleged that they had a binding past practice. And so it was a binding past practice. It was around an issue that the union asserted was a mandatory subject of bargaining, take-home vehicles. This wasn't a purely managerial issue. This was something that affected wages, affected compensation, it affected, you know, safety and other working conditions. You know, the financial benefits obviously were fuel and mileage, you know, costs related to cars. And there were the safety interests that were asserted, and I've seen this argued both ways, that the risks of traveling to and from work in an area where you live and work, especially in a small area where everybody knows who everybody else is, that maybe there are some additional risks to you and people, you know, people will identify you out of uniform and know that, you know, he drives this car or she drives this car. And so there are protections by not having to do that, you know, when you make it into your town and everybody sees you as a police officer. I've seen that. I've also seen the opposite, you know, argued. But that was, those were the two main arguments that the union offered as to, you know, why the take-home vehicle policy was a mandatory subject of bargaining, because it affected their wages and it affected other working conditions. And safety is a condition of work. The union cited National Labor Relations Act precedent, you know, regarding this. And, you know, labor boards aren't just bound necessarily by their own state laws. You know, that's, they can't, you know, they are going to be bound by what happens, you know, potentially, you know, in the courts or in their prior board decisions. You know, that's authority. We call that in my business. But you can also look, right? We can look to the National Labor Relations Board for the standards that are applied to private sector employees, or we can look at what other states have done with similar issues. Courts can consider all that. It might be persuasive to them. It might not be. And all the laws are generally similar. That's how we can have an international podcast, right? The laws are all kind of the same. You know, there are differences in each state, but, you know, more similarities than differences. And so the union cited National Labor Relations Act case law decisions by the NLRB. The union also cited labor board decisions from other states in places like Washington and New York and in Florida and in Nebraska, places where it was very clear that take-home vehicles for police officers were mandatory bargaining subjects and couldn't be changed without bargaining. What did the village say in response? And so the union said, when you change this, right, it was a mandatory subject of bargaining. We had a binding past practice. You changed it without bargaining. That's a no-no. It's a legal no-no. We win. The village didn't see it that way. The village said, you know, this isn't a binding benefit. This was a temporary, I'm quoting from the case, a temporary discretionary accommodation implemented during an unprecedented health emergency. And what the union's trying to do here is convert this temporary thing that we did to address a once in a lifetime until the next time thing can't be converted into a permanent benefit. And that's what they're trying to do. The original policy that they implemented back in 2004 on its face said that this was an exercise of management discretion and would actually be subject to revocation. They said, you know, even when we rolled the original version of this out, we said we weren't stuck with it. The 2020 change, you know, they just described as a temporary deviation to adjust COVID. They said it wasn't bargained. We never sat down with these folks. They never asked for it. You know, we certainly never agreed to provide it in writing, the expansion. It wasn't even approved by the village board. You know, this was just kind of a managerial change that they made. They basically said this was a procedure, not a policy. There's like no, by the way, I have no idea what they were getting at with that, because I don't know the difference between the two necessarily. There's no legal distinction that I can see, or the board, by the way. And they said, look, you know, we had the discretion to provide this benefit. We had the discretion to revoke it, and we did revoke it. And by the way, you know, we revoked it in good faith. You know, we implemented it in good faith. And in September 2025, you know, by that point, the costs of the program were just enormous. And we decided that we needed to end it in order to be fiscally responsible. Again, I don't know how enormous the cost could have been, but, you know, that's what they said. They said, you know, we're not doing it because we were mad at somebody or because they got a big raise in bargaining, or, you know, they said we have real reasons here. And there's no reason to dispute that, that they had legitimate reasons anyway. What did the board say about it? Well, I mean, the board first, you know, said that, you know, reiterated what the standard is here, right? And the standard is that you cannot make unilateral changes to mandatory bargaining subjects, right? We know that that's the rule. And that's not just limited to language in a CBA, right? It also applies to past practices. And so if an employer makes a unilateral change to something that would constitute a binding past practice, then that's going to violate New Mexico law if they make that change, of course, without bargaining. And the board relied on the same National Labor Relations Board precedent and other state labor board precedents that were cited by the union, you know, in defense of their charge. Now, once the past practice has been established, according to the board, you can only change it via bargaining. And so the first question is, was there a past practice? And so what the court did was apply the the standards that we have regarding whether a past practice can be established or has been established or not. You know, there's a lot of confusion about this, which is why we spend time talking about it at seminars. But, you know, and the thing I always go back to is the saying, do for one, do for all, right? You know, I hear that all the time in public safety organizations, do for one, do for all. Well, I mean, that's not true. I mean, that might be a good policy. That might be a good, you know, we don't want to treat people differently or pick and choose on why we do things. But to just because the employer does something once for one officer or one firefighter doesn't mean they have to do it for everybody else, right? But if you do that thing enough and for a long enough period of time, and in the cases would say in an open and continuous manner, at some point that can become binding, you know, a binding past practice, so that now there's actually an agreement. People build lives around it, right? You know, in Hatch, none of this was in the case, but, you know, people might have made decisions about what kind of car they were going to buy, right? You know, maybe I would prefer to have a gas guzzler, but I got to drive 40 miles back and forth to work. So I'm going to get some crappy, you know, car that does better on mileage, or God forbid I get it like at some kind of electric hybrid-y kind of deal, you know, that has fake engine sounds, you know, but I do it, you know, as a money saver. Well, you know, if I don't have to do that anymore, right? If I don't have to take my 40 mile commute, then I might buy, you know, the big truck that's going to, you know, guzzle a lot of gas because I'm not going to be driving as much, right? People make decisions about that. And maybe I got a 5-year lease on a car that I'm stuck with. I can't even make a decision, you know, to sell that now if situations change by virtue of the employer changing their take-home vehicle policy. Now, again, I don't know that that happened in this case, but, you know, people do make decisions, right, around workplace practices, and that may have been here. The labor board, you know, applied those standards to the take-home vehicle policy and said, yeah, you know, this is a past practice. You know, how long does it take, by the way, you know, for something to constitute a past practice? 3 months, you know, 6 months, a year? And there's no answer. You know, it's case by case. And in fact, even the labor board, this is a quote, there's no magic number to establish longevity, but the standard is that it endured over such a period of time that the employee may rely and reasonably expect such practice to continue, right? That's the quote from the case, right? There's no magic number, but enough that people would rely on it and expect that it would continue. Here, 5 years in the labor board's view was enough. You know, the board noted the significant personal benefit that the benefit provided to employees, right? Reduced commuting costs, also the safety advantages, and that it did so over an extended period of time. The board specifically noted that the fact that it involved village-owned property didn't remove it from the scope of bargaining, right? So the mere fact that the town or the village owns these cars in and of itself doesn't make this a purely managerial item. It is still something that could be subject to bargaining. Keep that in the back of your head, by the way, because other states may see that a little bit differently. And so because the program here, the THV program, was a past practice, and it was a mandatory subject to bargaining, and the village changed it, or in fact got rid of it, without bargaining, the village then had violated the law. And so what the labor board did was they sustained the charges and ordered the village to restore the THV policy and to post, you know, that we broke the law, blah, 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 blah. And the board said, you know, listen, we don't care about, not that we don't care, but, you know, there were legitimate arguments, and we understand the employer's position that, you know, we did this in good faith. We got rid of it in good faith. We weren't trying to hurt anybody. They said, that's not enough, right? Budget woes, or the fact that something wasn't bargained on the front end, you know, it's not a defense, you know, under New Mexico law. And in fact, under most states law, you know, in fact, under all states law, it's not going to be a defense absent some extraordinary event, you know, ordinary budget woes, aren't going to be a defense to avoid your obligations under state labor law. Remember, for listeners of the podcast, we've talked about, I call it the flip side of recruiting and retention, where we've actually seen some labor board decisions on, you know, attendance policies or things like that, that ordinarily would be bargainable, where labor boards have let employers, I would say, let employers get away with making changes without bargaining over things that ordinarily would have to be bargained. because of the staffing crisis, because of, you know, if you can tie back the thing you want to do to this kind of unprecedented staffing crisis that we're in and explain why we need to make this change and how extraordinary the circumstances are, the greater your chances of getting away with whatever it is that you did. And so, you know, there are going to be exceptions, but in this particular case in the village of Hatch, the employer wasn't able to get away with it. It reminds me, I had a case a long time ago in a place involving a pension plan. And, you know, depending on where you are in the country, you may be familiar with DROP, deferred retirement benefits. And these are retirement benefits where once you reach regular retirement eligibility, you can have your, you know, essentially retire for pension purposes, have your benefit calculated, and then continue to work for X period of time and have your monthly pension payments go into essentially a savings account for you that's going to earn money while you continue to work. And it's basically like, you know, saying, hey, I'm going to get a pension for the next 30 years. Give me a lump sum of it now. Give me a bigger portion of it now. And my monthly benefit's going to be a little lower in recognition of that. Right? Because if I retire now, my pension is going to be calculated on my salary now, as opposed to 5 years from now, when hopefully my salary will be higher, right? And so my monthly pension benefit should be a little bit lower. That's basically how drops work. I was in a place where they wanted to do a drop. The employer wouldn't do a drop. It's for police and fire. And one of the reasons the employer didn't want to do a drop was because the employees, once you entered the drop, you were no longer an active employee. And this was in a state where there was a state aid system where the municipality would get money from the state for every active officer and every active firefighter they had. So if you entered a drop, you know, one could argue that you were no longer an active firefighter, and then the employer is going to lose state money to subsidize their pension costs. So it's going to make your pension more expensive, at least for the employer. And so, but the employer really wanted to do a drop because they wanted to downsize and they wanted to have a bunch of senior people enter and then not backfill those vacancies is really what they wanted to do. And so they came up with this reverse drop where you would, you know, pretend, you know, and reach the date that you were going to enter the drop ordinarily, continue to work for a few more years, and then file to retire and enter the drop 4 years ago and have your pension be calculated as if you retired 4 years ago. And it would look and feel the same as if you had done a drop prospectively. But the difference is because you actually were active during those 4 years, you could still get state aid. So it was a scam, right? It was a scam to get state aid. And, you know, and you got to respect the scam, right? I'm like, oh gosh, that's pretty interesting. The employer wanted to do that. They didn't just do it. They asked the unions if the unions would sign off on it. I represented, worked with one of the unions at that point in time. And they came to us and they said, we want you to agree to this. And we looked at it and we said, no, we're not going to agree to this. We think you're scamming the state out of money. You know, you can do it if you want. We're not going to file a charge. We're not going to stand in your way if you do it, but we don't want to be party to it. And that's exactly what happened. The employer went forward and they implemented this, this reverse drop. And all was well and good until a few years later, the state, you know, doing a regular audit, got wind of what they were doing and did what we thought they would do. They called the employer and said, you owe us $1 million in state aid that we gave you because of this fake system that you came up with. And the employer's response was, oh no, what are we going to do? And they immediately went to their city council and they amended their pension ordinance to get rid of the reverse drop. Then what did the union do? Management people, you know what the union did. Union people, you know what the union did. The union said, not so fast, my friend. You can't get rid of that reverse drop benefit without our consent. You have to bargain with us if you want to change it. And they said, what are you talking about? We wanted you to agree with this. You refused to agree to this. You let us go ahead and do it. You know, now you're saying we can't change it without your consent. And we said, yeah, absolutely. That is exactly what we're saying because that's the way the process works. Employer didn't agree. The union filed a charge. The case made it all the way up. It's Pennsylvania, to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. It's out of the city of Erie. The case is probably 15 years old at this point. But, you know, the court reiterated that, no, it doesn't matter if the union didn't agree to whatever it was in the front end. If we're talking about a mandatory subject of bargaining and the employer changes it, you know, without bargaining, you know, they're going to be on the hook. And that's exactly what happened in that case involving the drop. And so, you know, whether it's a really big case like that with a pension benefit, or sometimes employers will do, you know, education incentives or tuition reimbursement or things that really were like, we just want to do this initiative. They can be stuck with those on the back end if they don't plan it out right. And so employers, you know, if you're going to do that, you might want to say, we're going to try this, but union, we want you to agree that if it doesn't work, you know, we might have the right to take it back. And union, you may agree, great, we don't have it now, let's take it. Or you may say, no, we don't want to do that because we don't want to get used to something, and then have the employer have the ability to say, oh yeah, we're going to take this away, and you gave us the right to, you know, to piss members off as leverage. And so always be thinking about, you know, how does this affect us in the next round of bargaining and all that fun stuff. All right. So that's how take-home vehicles relate to those types of arguments in New Mexico, and I guess to a certain extent in Pennsylvania. How about New Jersey, right? Because our second case is out of Pleasantville, New Jersey. It was decided by the New Jersey Public Employees Relations Commission a little earlier this year. Pleasantville is a little bigger than Hatch. And we're talking about not a ton bigger, 20,000 people, I think about 50 or 60 officers, you know, in that police department. They had a take-home vehicle policy. And in November of 2024, that city made a change. They didn't eliminate the take-home vehicle policy. And in fact, not everybody got take-home vehicles. So it wasn't like take-home patrol vehicles like in Hatch. I don't know if they were all unmarked. It's not clear in the case, but that was my sense, is there's probably a mix of marked and unmarked take-home vehicles for top brass, for supervisors, and for on-call detectives. That's who had the take-home vehicles. What the employer did was they tightened it up. In November of 24, they said, now we're just going to keep them for the big bosses. There's probably like two in that department. And we're going to get rid of it for, you know, the 10 other people that have take-home vehicles. No bargaining with the union, nothing like that. They got rid of it. What did the union do? Union filed a ULP. And they said, hey, there's nothing in the contract about this, right? Union made filed a charge and said, you made a change, right? You unilaterally changed something that's a mandatory subject of bargaining. And you didn't talk to us about it. And you certainly didn't get our agreement about it. So you were going to go to the labor board and they're going to make you reverse it. The problem is that's not what happened in this particular case. And that's because New Jersey has a different way of looking at this particular subject of bargaining, and that's take-home vehicles. In New Jersey, at least in this particular case and in other cases, the labor board said that a take-home vehicle policy or the availability of take-home vehicles is not a mandatory subject of bargaining. And the reason for that is that, you know, in New Jersey, the view is that a public employer has a managerial prerogative to control the deployment of its own vehicle fleet. Right? These are employer vehicles. And basically the rule is, no, these are their vehicles. We can't tell them how to deploy their vehicles, or it's not a mandatory subject of bargaining. But there is a middle ground. There's a lesser obligation. And depending on where you are in the country, you know, by the way, when we talk about a mandatory subject of bargaining, sometimes we talk about this concept of decisional bargaining, you know, we say. And, you know, that basically means, look, you can't do this unless the union agrees. You know, management. And that's the best type of obligation. That's what you want on the union end. But it's not either decisional bargaining or nothing. You know, there's a middle ground. In some places, we call it impact bargaining. In some places, we call it effects bargaining. In other places, we call them, it's mixed case bargaining. Jersey calls it mixed case, you know, bargaining. It's the same thing. And basically what this means is for this particular issue, a take-home vehicle policy, the employer has the right to decide whether they're going to have a take-home vehicle policy or whether they're going to make it better or whether they're going to make it worse, right? Those are managerial decisions, but they do have an obligation to negotiate over offsetting compensation for employees who may have lost the economic benefit of using the employer's vehicle, right? So they can make the decision, but they have to bargain over what I would call the impact of that decision, the effects of those decisions. And the rules are different in different states as to, you know, can you do it? If there's an impact, can you do it and then bargain later? Or if there's any type of bargaining obligation, do you have to wait? New Jersey is one of the states where the employer can act. They can make the change. They can eliminate the take-home vehicle policy, or in this case, they can reduce it. They can make it more restrictive. And then after they've done that, sit down with the union and bargain, you know, maybe to impasse over, you know, what type of financial offset the officers who were negatively affected by this might be entitled to. So that's how it works in Jersey, right? It's not like in New Mexico, and it's not as simple. And there's another thing that's kind of interesting about effects bargaining, impact bargaining rights. And it's almost like, you know, in discipline cases, the right to have a union representative, right? We talk about how Weingarten rights, it's not the same as Miranda rights, you know, which automatically attach. You know, Weingarten rights don't exist in most places, depending on what your Bill of Rights may or may not say, if you have one in your state. Okay, set all that aside, but Weingarten rights generally don't attach until the employee asks, right? So I might have a right to a union rep in an investigatory interview, but if I don't ask for the union rep, I don't have that right. And if management just interviews me, you know, without the union rep present, they haven't violated anything. You know, the rules are kind of analogous with respect to impact bargaining, meaning that in order for there to be an obligation to impact bargain or effects bargain or mixed case bargain in New Jersey, you have to demand bargaining. And for whatever reason, in this particular case, and there was a fact dispute over whether the union did or didn't demand bargaining, the labor board determined, based on this review of the facts, this hearing examiner for the labor board, it's a first level decision, determined that the union didn't demand bargaining. You know, so they didn't say, you made this change, we demand bargaining, let's go through this. And the employer didn't refuse to bargain because the union never demanded bargaining. They just went right to filing a charge. And so in the labor board's view, there was no violation here because we were talking about a lesser bargaining obligation that needed a bargaining demand that didn't happen, right? So in this particular instance, no ULP and no change to the take-home vehicle policy. So two different changes, two different states, two different standards, two different outcomes. That's why lawyers have jobs, which is great. Okay, on to case number three, and we are going to stay on the East Coast. We got two East Coast cases that we're going to finish with. One, I like this case. It's a direct dealing case. Everyone likes direct dealing cases because they're interesting. It's in Onondaga County, New York. I probably said it wrong. I know people in New York, they're going to make fun of me. It's like where Syracuse is. All right. So not a, you know, you probably don't want to be there in January. In early February, by the way, come on out to Vegas. We're going to do a collective bargaining seminar. If you're in upstate New York, it'll be much nicer in Las Vegas. And this is the sheriff's office in Onondaga County. So it's probably like 500,000 people live there. So we're getting a little bigger, right? And it's a sheriff that has kind of a split, like law enforcement jurisdiction, and also kind of a custody and corrections responsibility. This is the custody and corrections group. It's probably about 200 correctional officers that we're talking about. And so, this group, they were under contract. Their contract expired at the end of 2023. Oh, I should probably give you the name of the case. In the matter of Deputy Sheriff's Benevolent Association of Onondaga County versus County of Onondaga, it's a PERB case. Again, the site's in the show notes. And same thing, the last case was called City of Pleasantville, a New Jersey PERC decision from earlier this year. Okay, back to what we're talking about. It's 2023. It's a bargaining year. Contract expires at the end of 2023. We're in November. It hasn't started yet. Bargaining hasn't even started yet, which is a little, I don't know. And you got to start earlier, by the way. Okay. But bargaining hasn't started yet. It's all good. Maybe that's how they do it there. The sheriff gets the chief of, you know, I guess chief of corrections. I don't know what it is, but the chief deputy sheriff, to contact the union president to propose a schedule change. And those officers were working eights. It was like a 4-2 schedule. It was 1,946 annual hours. So it's like a 37-hour work week on average. The sheriff wanted to move to tens, and it would be a 4-4-4-3 schedule as it rolls over. Same number of hours in the year, you know, obviously some differences, more scheduled days off, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, the officers, and you say, hey, we want to do this. What do you think about it? The union president's contract year, by the way, union president takes it back to the board. The board talks about it a little bit, and they basically decide, no, we don't want to do that. And they also say, look, just bring it up at the table. It's complicated because there wasn't much to it other than do you want to go to tens, and here's how we'll do it. Ordinarily, groups are pretty receptive to tens, and the science would say that 10s are generally a safer schedule than 8s. In corrections, I think that there's a lot of folks that feel like the shorter the shift, the better. And I think that there was some of that in the record in this case, that the sense of the group was really 8 hours is what we want. Now, was it that, or was it, it's the out year, it's contract negotiations, the employer has asked us to do something, they've told us they want to do something. Did the union just say, yeah, let's make them ask for it at the table. Maybe we'll get something for it. I'm shocked. Maybe that happened. Maybe it didn't. I don't know. But the sheriff floats the change, the union kicks it around, and there's a text exchange in early November, which is in the record. I love this. It's the chief follows up and it's like, hey, what's going on with the, you know, with the schedule change offer? And the response from the union president starts out, I'm in the tree stand. this is great. He's hunting, hunting up in upstate New York. I'm in the tree stand, didn't go well. The board doesn't want to make a change. I think just like hold, now I'm not quoting, but now, hold off, bring it up at the table. We'll talk it through then. That was basically it. So early November, they shoot it down. No response, crickets, nothing in response. I mean, they saw each other, but there was no substantive response, no further discussion about the schedule change. A couple of weeks go ahead, we're coming up on Thanksgiving, and the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, the department emails to every deputy, right? Every deputy sheriff in the bargaining unit, they get an email asking them, they don't have to, but asking them to complete an online anonymous survey to gauge their interest in the 10-hour shift schedule, the 4443 schedule. And there were some details, but not a lot. It was like, hey, how would you like to do this schedule? We're probably going to do it on a one-year pilot. We're interested in your thoughts, as we head into negotiations. So it's like a pre-bargaining survey of the members, but done by the employer, not the union. And so what did the union do? The union went apeshit. And by the way, this was an email to everybody. So now it starts reply alls, the worst thing. Some of the reply alls, somebody was like, I voted yes. Unfortunately, our union president is not for this idea, right? So, this is one of the reasons why we don't really want employers reaching out to everybody, because now we're going to have people debating out in the open. It can undermine solidarity. It can do any number of things. But we get emails in response. The union president immediately contacts the sheriff and says, this is inappropriate. You have to stop it. This is illegal direct dealing. We demand that you take down the survey. The sheriff does not take down the survey immediately. They leave it open. This was a Wednesday before Thanksgiving. They left it open through the weekend. They opened it on Monday. And, it's not like people weren't working, but so people were there. People got it. People completed the survey. I don't know what percentage of the bargaining unit completed. There was some testimony of people said, no, we didn't complete it. But certainly some people completed it. The sheriff took it down, and there's testimony in the record saying they took it down earlier than they would have, earlier than they wanted to leave it open, partly because they didn't want to deal with a charge, which they got anyway. But so it was open for a week. The union filed a charge alleging that the employer violated the Taylor Law by engaging in improper direct dealing. What else happens? A couple months later, right? Contract's not resolved yet. We're in the early spring. The sheriff appears at a roll call. It's like, hey guys, just want to give everybody an update about current events and talking about things. Another county facility had made a change from 8s to 10s. And so the sheriff cites that. Oh, and this other facility moved to 10s. It's going great. And makes the quote from cases, you could have had that schedule. And some of the officers are like, what do you mean we could have had that schedule? That sounds good. And he's like, well, you should ask the union president. I don't know. And leaves it at that. Union files another charge, right, for the sheriff undermining the union at this, individual meeting with bargaining unit members. And so this case makes its way to the labor board, and the board issues a resolution. And it first, talks a little bit about direct dealing, right? So what are the rules around direct dealing allegations? And in order to state a claim of illegal, of improper direct dealing, the union must allege sufficient facts that the employer, now it's quote, impermissibly bypassed the employee organization for the purpose of negotiating or attempting to negotiate with an employee or group of employees aimed at reaching an agreement on the subject under discussion, close quote, right? So that's the quote from the case. So it's basically an end around the union for the purpose of bargaining an agreement, of trying to negotiate something, okay? Ask yourself, is that what happened here? So the board talks a little bit more about it. So unlike other, speech that's directed to employees, direct dealing need not be coercive in nature. So it doesn't need to be a threat or anything. because direct dealing is by its very nature aimed at impeding negotiations or subverting the fundamental rights of employees, blah, 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 blah. You know, if you can just go right to the employees and I go around the bargaining unit, right? I do an end around. Have I undermined the credibility of the elected leadership of the union? You're damn right I have, right? You know, that's a big problem for unions. If I go and I start emailing the members about, hey, what do you think about this proposal? You know, and essentially implying the union says, oh, everybody's opposed to this. You know, we're the representatives at the table and oh, the group doesn't like it. Well, let me just email the group and say, what do you think about it? And maybe the majority likes it, right? You know, that's a real problem. If you're a union president, you wouldn't want the sheriff doing that. I wouldn't if I was a union president. And so the board talks about, all right, well, you know, direct dealing is pretty serious, you know, but it has to be, you know, it has to be aimed at something, right? And so here, applied to these facts, which is, I disagree with the decision, but that's okay. You know, I don't always win, but this email was on the eve of negotiations, right? They haven't made a proposal yet, but they basically kind of said, we're going to make a proposal. What do you think about this proposal that we're going to make? The board said, no, there was no violation here. There was no direct dealing. And the quote from the case was that there was no exchange of promises in the conversations, right? There was no intent to reach any agreement with the union employees, and there was no bypass of the union. So, you know, they weren't asking people to support something. They weren't saying the union hasn't agreed to this. We would like you to agree to this. They couched it as, what would your interest be in this issue? You know, and the board goes on to say, you know, we don't see an intent to reach agreement. You know, this basically, it says it was sent intended to gauge interest in a schedule. And that was it. You know, there was no proposal. There was no offer. They didn't ask for agreement or anything along those lines. And so, you know, in this particular case, you know, in New York, you know, the board determined that, you know, that bar is pretty high on direct dealing. You know, I think sometimes unions feel like anytime the employer talks to any individual member about something, it's direct dealing. What this case tells us, at least in New York, and I, you know, it's probably pretty typical, is that's not true. Like, you can have conversations. Now, if you go to an individual member and you try to negotiate a settlement of their grievance and the union's not involved, that could be a problem. But if you're talking to members on a shift about, hey, what do you guys think about maybe going to 8s or 12s or whatever? In New York, under these facts, the labor board said that that wasn't direct dealing. Whether another labor board or even this board under a little different facts, you know, you might have reached a different conclusion. I don't know. I don't know. It's absent in the case. Like, what happened in negotiations? What kind of proposals were made about the shift? Where did it end up? None of that's here in the case. I don't know. But like, those are pretty important cases or facts. And these cases turn on facts. What about the statements made about the union president at roll call? The board shot that down too. The board said, no, they really just weren't serious enough. Like, and the quote is, I don't find that the statements rose to the level of meddling in the internal affairs of the union or trying to control the union. There's no evidence that the comments were made for the purpose of trying to control who the union selected as a representative. They do point to the union leader in addressing the question of why the center doesn't have the proposed new schedule, but the comments stop there. And they cited facts from cases where there were violations and where the employer said things like, you don't have to listen to the union president. Why are you listening to the president? Why do you follow him? That's why you lose all your cases. Really, you know, kind of a step too far in directly undermining the union. I think this one's undermining the union. You know, oh, why didn't you get this? Well, maybe talk to the union president. What's the implication there? The implication is your union president screwed something up and you don't have a schedule now that you want because the union president did something. I mean, how does that not undermine the union president, in my view? But the labor board saw it differently. And so, you know, direct dealing cases are interesting. You know, this all takes place in the context of like these larger continuing relationships. And so I would caution people about getting too close to the line either way with respect to that. Employers, just because you can, you know, maybe go a little further than some people might think, all you're going to do is piss off the union. And how much closer is that going to get you to an agreement or a good working relationship? And those are, you know, that's the difference between short-term and long-term, you know, and something for people to consider. Okay, we have one more case, and we're going to go to Medford, Massachusetts. So we're going you know, further and further north, colder and colder. Medford, Massachusetts, it's bigger than, you know, Pleasant. It's like 60,000 people. This is a fire department case. There's like 150 firefighters there. Do you want to know where Amelia Earhart was born? I think you know where Amelia Earhart was born. She was born in Medford, Massachusetts. So good for her. That's all I have to say about Amelia Earhart. All right. This particular case it's a repudiation case, which we don't see too many repudiation cases, and that's why I like talking about it. And what's a repudiation case? So, you know, there are different ways an employer can violate the law, you know, your bargaining law with respect to wages and benefits and terms and conditions of employment. And usually, like, whether it's in the take-home vehicle case or even in the direct dealing case, the employer has done something that constitutes a refusal to bargain, right? They changed something that they had to bargain over, right? And in most of those instances, hopefully in most of those instances, the employer believed they had the right to do it, right? In the New Mexico take-home vehicle case, the employer is like, no, we cannot be bound by this policy. We did it out of the goodness of our heart during COVID. Like, we can't be stuck with this. They didn't think they were wrong, right? So the employer believes they have the right to do something. The union believes they don't. We go to a labor board. The board tells us whether there was a refusal to bargain or not. Repudiation is the next level. Repudiation is where you're alleging, not only, you know, are we right and they're wrong, they know they're wrong. The contract says they have to do this thing and they are deliberately not doing it, right? They're repudiating the CBA. It's an extra violation, right? It's like being on double secret probation. It's a more serious form of violation. It can, in some instances, give you a better remedy. The decision in and of itself might have some more value, especially politically, if there's a determination that the chief, you know, or somebody who's appointed, and we're all in politics here, has repudiated the contract. That might be harmful to them, might be helpful. But there's some value there. But in some places, you know, you might be able to get a better remedy. So they might have to pay fees. They might have to provide some type of economic benefit that's above and beyond what you might normally get in a labor case. So we have this case out of Massachusetts. It's a repudiation. It's actually two separate repudiation charges in the fire department. And so they had to do with the grievance procedure. And, you know, in this particular instance, it's a two-step grievance procedure, but it's really a three-step grievance procedure. In this case, the City of Medford and Medford Firefighters Union, Local 1032. And this is a Massachusetts Labor Relations Commission case. They've got a two-step, but really a three-step grievance procedure. And so step one is the chief, you know, the fire chief. Step two goes to the mayor or the mayor's designee. And then within step two, it says, and if it isn't worked out at step two, you can go to arbitration. So that's really step three, right? So that's why I say it's really step three. But this case has there are disputes about step two, and there were changes with respect to the step two process. I'm going to read you the language. Just so that you know what it is. So step two says, within 10 calendar days after the presentation of a grievance to the mayor or his designate, the grievance committee shall meet with the mayor or his designate to discuss and attempt to adjust the grievance. If the grievance cannot be adjusted satisfactorily within 3 weeks of its presentation to the mayor or his designate, it may thereafter be submitted, blah, 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 to arbitration. Okay, so you've got 10 days, right? It says within you present a step two grievance to the mayor or their designee is usually what I see. And it says within 10 days, there has to be a meeting with the mayor to discuss an attempt to adjust the grievance. And if it's not adjusted, then you have 3 weeks to go to arbitration. The contract doesn't spell out a consequence. It doesn't say if you don't conduct the meeting or if you don't provide an answer, the grievance is automatically sustained. It doesn't do anything like that. It's silent. It just says you have to do this thing. And then if not, you just go to arbitration. Not too unusual. And what was happening in Medford, it was how they did it anyway, was for years, they actually would have step two hearings. The mayor's chief of staff would conduct the meetings. And it was almost like I picture like a Judge Judy situation. So it was like you'd go to the step two meeting. The union president would present the grievance. It had already gone to the fire chief. Fire chief had denied the grievance, right? So we go to the step two meeting. The chief of staff is there. The union rep is there. And the fire chief is there. And the union president would say, all right, here's why we're right and the fire chief is wrong, right? And then the fire chief would say, no, here's why I'm right. Here's why the union president's wrong. And that would all go to the chief of staff who was there at the meeting. When the meeting was done, the chief of staff would deliberate and then provide a written answer at some point later. That's how step two meetings worked, right? So it wasn't just kind of two parties on either side of the table. It was really three parties, but two were the city. That's how they did them. And they did that way for many years. There was a change in 2021, new chief of staff, new HR person. The chief of staff goes to a couple of step two meetings and he goes, this is bullshit. I'm not going to go to these anymore. It's a waste of my time. That's why we have an HR director. HR director, you are now going to step two meetings. And so they had a couple, and it was the same format. And then the HR director decided, why am I hearing from the fire chief? I'm the fire chief. I'm the city. So we're going to have step two meetings, but the union's going to make their presentation and then we're done. You make your argument, no discussion. We're just stop and say, we'll get back to you. Okay. And they did that in 21. They did it all year. And that was kind of it. They kept doing it into 2022. And there were two grievances that actually wound up in resolving charges. They did this. They did the same thing at a grievance in May of 22. They schedule a step two meeting. It was like they show up, the union reads a piece of paper and they leave, right? There was no discussion. There was no attempt to resolve anything at the meeting. The union filed a charge on that and said that the change in the procedure we used to have back and forth at these meetings, we don't have that anymore, that change, right, was a unilateral change or repudiation of our clear contract. That was one thing that happened. And then right around the same time, the employer, they must have said, we don't even want to, what's the point? We deny all these grievances anyway. Why are we even having these meetings? You can just go to arbitration. So they just stopped having step two meetings altogether. The union would ask for a step two meeting. The city was like, nah, we're just not going to respond. And some employers do this. They just ignore it. And they hope that the union blows the timeline in sending it to the next step. That's what was going on here. The union did send everything to the next step. But on top of that, they said, no, you're repudiating the contract. You have to hold step two hearing. We have to discuss this grievance and we're going to hold you to the letter of our contract because that's what our contract says. And they filed a charge on that too. And so that's what was before the labor board in that particular case. And so, the board issued a split decision. But clarified a little bit the standard for repudiation, at least in Massachusetts. And the board said that a public employer's, quote, deliberate refusal to abide by an unambiguous collectively bargained agreement constitutes a repudiation of that agreement. And that's in violation of Massachusetts labor law. The board applied that standard to the city's decision not to hold step two hearings and not surprisingly decided in favor of the union, right? The judge said here, it's indisputed that the city did not respond to the union after the union submitted for the light duty and return to work grievances at step two on May 31st, and that the mayor or his or her designate never met with the union to discuss those grievances at step two, right? And so, the board said that it's very clear that the contract says you have to have a meeting. It says you have to discuss the grievances. You didn't do it. And that constitutes repudiation because it's an unambiguous requirement. Whether the employer says, yeah, but it doesn't matter. We were going to deny the grievance anyway, is where you kind of move into, well, maybe there's just bad faith bargaining. Of course, they're not going to argue that. They may believe that. But the board's saying, listen, the contract says you have to meet. So you got to meet. And the board sided in favor of the union. The board decided against the union regarding the change in the formats of the step two meetings before they killed it. And you might, if you were listening, understand why they did it. The change happened back in 2021. This was like a year after they made the change. The union filed a charge protesting it. And the board said, you're out of time on that. That was untimely. That may or may not be a repudiation, but we're not going to get to that because the charge is untimely. However, that step two requirement is a requirement. City of Medford, when you decided that you weren't going to go to these step two hearings anymore, you repudiated the collective bargaining agreement. In the meantime, maybe as a result of this charge, both those grievances were settled favorably by the party. I don't know why they didn't resolve the charge as part of that, but there's always a backstory. Who the heck knows? But the board said, hey, listen, ordinarily we would order a make-whole remedy. The matters have been resolved. So we're just going to order the city right, to comply with its step two meeting requirements and remedial order than to post the violation. No mention in Massachusetts, and I think it's a little more difficult there to get to this issue. Well, should you have to pay the union's legal fees, right? Should you have to pay the union's costs that they incurred because of this? Not in this particular case, but in many states, that is going to be a possibility. And so, you know, that's usually when you look at a repudiation charge, you know, in places like California or Illinois, Jersey, Washington State, you know, it's going to be an extra violation where there's going to be some type of extra, you know, usually financial consequence for the employer. And so we don't see them that much. Thought it was interesting, thought it was worthwhile talking about. And with that, I think that brings us to the end of, you know, we're basically just over an hour of this month's podcast. Yeah, hope we did, you know, we covered a lot of things. Next month, I don't know, maybe we'll go back to a single issue. I haven't the foggiest idea. I hope you guys have a really great June. Come out and see us in Vegas in June or in September or in Nashville in November. Check us out online at lrs.com. If you want any more information about stuff, you can always email me at info@lrs.com. That's it for First Thursday. Have a very safe month, and we will talk to you in July.